Jessica Michelle's going to come this morning, and she's going to lead them as they share what God is doing.
Hey guys, my name is Michelle, and I'm the Connections Minister, and Randy just introduced you to Stephen and Jason, but I want to also introduce you to Jess. She is married to Stephen, and at the church, she leads children's ministry. She heads up all things social media, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of everything. Sounds about right. So we're so excited that they're here this morning, and Mary told us about what God has done, what he was doing at camp this week. Like Randy said, we have so much to celebrate, and so I want to hear from you guys. What is something amazing that you've seen God do since the launch?
Yeah, so I think that the most amazing thing was we early on adopted. We knew that God was calling us into the foster and adoptive care space. Like, we knew that we wanted to take care of those families and those kids. And so we went to an organization called Olive Crest, and we said, hey, look, we don't have a lot, but we have a building, and this building is God's building, and this building is for the community, so please use it whenever you can. So they called me a couple weeks later, and they said, hey, I know Easter is the Super Bowl, and before she could even really get out what they wanted to do, I said, yes, if we have to move our service, if we have to cancel our service, if we, whatever you need, we'll do it because we want to serve the community. And so they hosted an Easter egg hunt and an Easter event for their foster families that they are a licensing agency. Five different churches packed baskets and eggs for them. We hosted them. Over 150 people came to the building, families full of different ethnicities, different ability levels. It was incredible to see God using this space already to love their community.
What I love about that is church planting is not about buildings. Churches are not about buildings. But if y'all remember last year for our anniversary offering, we were raising money to help finish out the building that they had. So thank you for sharing with us what God is doing with that, what's something that only he can do with that. So that's exciting.
Yeah. Absolutely. My amazing thing is kind of in the same vein, also with kids. So at the very end of April, we had our church's very first baby dedication. We dedicated three kids, one of which was Sparrow, our Sparrow, to God. And we stood up in front of our church families, and as parents, we said, we are committing to raise our kids to know Jesus, and our church family committed alongside us to grow these kids in godly wisdom in a place where that's not the popular thing. So it was just amazing to see that next generation.
Yeah. So I think one of my favorite things that we've gotten to see God do since y'all started the process of getting this church in Federal Way is actually connecting Jason to you guys. Like, that was kind of a crazy story. And he is such an asset to the team. Will one of y'all share what makes him such an asset?
Yeah, so not only is he stunningly handsome, but he filled a need. We needed someone to lead worship. Drum solos aren't really worshipful. So we needed someone to do that. But we really, what we needed was someone that was going to be on board with our mission and vision. And he heard the mission and vision, and he said, yes, I'm all in. I want to see this in Federal Way. He's a Federal Way native, so he's been there almost his whole life. He went to high school there. He has friends there. He has a connection there. He also represents the largest people group in Federal Way, which is Korean American. And so now we as a church get to start looking like our community as well, and we get to love the Korean American community better because of his insights, because we get to hear his voice, and so it's just an amazing thing God did.
Awesome. All right, well, share with us an update. Tell us what's going on now.
So we just launched our third service. We are building, like, getting out of our build. No, we're not. We don't have that many people. We barely have enough for one service. Let's be really clear. But we thought that maybe God would explode, right? Like, God would just bless, and then we'd have a miracle where just people are coming out of the woodwork. And that didn't happen. But we did. God is doing exactly what we thought God would do, which is growing us slowly. He's allowing people to come and to check us out, people who are like, no, that's not my thing. It's too small. I'm looking for something different. And that's okay. But also people who said, you know what? I want to get in the ground floor. I want to be invested. And so we're really just kind of trying to love the people that we have right now while building a platform of service to our community. Church planting is missionary work, and you really have to do something to get get the community's attention. And so we were trying to love our community really well. And so that's kind of where we are. We're 5 months in and just trying to find out how we can love our community and be an asset.
Awesome. All right, well, here's the burning question. What can we do to help, to support, to encourage you guys?
Yeah, great question. So you can follow us on social media. We have a Facebook, The Point Church at Federal Way. We have a podcast. If you're a podcast person, you can go to Spotify, listen to The Point Church podcast. You can get on our newsletter list. So if you go to our website, which is thepointfw.com, point has an E, just like Braz's point. If you go there, there's a link where you can sign up for our newsletter, and that will just put you on a list where you have email updates about twice-ish a month with specific prayer requests. So you can in real time know like things that we are needing, praises that we have. You can come. You can come and see what we are doing. You can come on a Brazos Point mission trip, or you can just bring your family to Seattle. Take your family vacation up there. Have fun. Join us for worship on Sunday. It's so invigorating and life-giving to have people from home visit us. It's just amazing to just have that refreshment, but also to be able to share, like, look at all the amazing things God is doing. Look at what we're doing, especially as y'all have been on board with us for a long time. And then right now, well, the biggest thing you can do is pray. Prayer is the work. It's so vitally important. We believe that prayer changes things. And our big prayer request right now is that two families would move, would uproot their lives, and come work alongside us in the Point Church. That's a big ask. It may seem impossible. You may be feeling like that's you. If you think that, please come have a conversation with us. And my challenge to you would be, even if it's big, even if it seems impossible, God is so much bigger. We've seen in our story him just provide over and over again in out of nowhere. And he will do the same for anyone he calls alongside us.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing that with us. And our hope, our prayer, is that when the team comes next week, that they'll get to be a part of, like you were talking about, connecting with the community more and letting the community see that you're there to invest in them and to serve them. So thanks for letting us come, and thanks for sharing with us today. Stephen is about to preach the message for today, but I wanted to let you guys know that the three of them will be over here in the connection point with an E corner after the service, and they would love to meet you. Stephen and Jess are Brazos Point folks, but this is actually Jason's first time here. He's been to Texas before, but not Southern Brazoria County. So y'all make sure to head over there after the service and give him a big old welcome. And also, I just want to echo what they have said a little bit, but church planting is uniquely hard, and it is often lonely and exhausting. So we want to send them back home full of encouragement. So y'all come see them after the service.
Thank you, Michelle. Because when Jess and I left Lake Jackson 3 years ago, almost to the day, by all earthly wisdom, it was reckless. If math and memory may not be your strong suit, let me tell you, that means we left in June of 2020, in the middle of the largest pandemic that the world has seen in 100 years. We left in a time where the only certainty was uncertainty. We left to go to a city where we had no jobs, where we knew absolutely no one, and we were kind of just hoping we were following God's will. One of my favorite theologians, the late R.C. Sproul, in a book he wrote called Everyone's a Theologian, wrote that we all kind of just guess about God's will. Anyone who tells you they know that they're following God's will doesn't really tell the truth. We can think, we can follow a lot of God's will, but really we don't know that we're following God's will until afterwards. And then we look back and say, yes, that was God's will, or no, it wasn't. And so we were pretty sure that we were following God's will. But it was reckless. We recklessly followed what we felt like God was calling us to, because God is kind of reckless. Now, I know that people don't like to attach that word to God's attributes, and they argue quite rightly that God never is really reckless because he knows the outcome. It's hard to be reckless when you already know what's going to happen. But those same people probably would say that, well, I've seen the hand of God work, or I just want to seek God's face. Y'all, God ain't got no hands. God ain't got no face. Right? So what we do is this is a big college word, we anthropomorphize God, meaning we attach human attributes to God. So when we say that I've seen God do something, we often say we've seen the hand of God. Or when we want to know God better, we ask to see God's face. But when thinking about what God does and who God is, I think that reckless is actually the only adjective that can really describe love and grace. Think of the song that we just sang that's conveniently titled Reckless Love. It describes God's love chasing us down, fighting until we're found, and leaving 99 to go find one. Now let's make this a little more concrete here. So let's say that I have, just out of the blue, maybe, I don't know, 100 pairs of shoes. I don't know. I definitely don't. This is totally hyperbole. Maybe I have a linen closet full of shoes back home, and I go on vacation, and I leave one pair of shoes, right? Well, I get home, and I discover that I've lost a pair of shoes that I love almost as much as my own child. I'm sorry, Sparrow. But I would be so much more sad than most of you probably if I got home and didn't have a pair of shoes. I would want to get on the phone and call and search around and pay for shipping or maybe take a trip back down to where I was to find these shoes. And I would end up spending more money than those shoes are probably worth. I'd probably be better off just buying a new pair of shoes or writing off that pair of shoes and saying, I've got 99, why do I need one more? It would be incredibly reckless for me to go search for that one pair of shoes. To our human understanding and sensibilities, leaving 99 to go get one is pretty reckless. Do you know that Jesus tells a story about this very thing? That song isn't just like poetry. That song is literally from Scripture. In Luke chapter 15, Jesus tells a set of three stories. We call them parables. If you have your Bibles, I'd love for you to open them. We're going to be in the book of Luke. Luke is a gospel or a biography of Jesus' life written by a man named Luke. And we're going to be in chapter 15. It's about three-fourths of the way through your Bible if you have a paper one. If you have a digital one, it's much easier to get to. So Jesus here, to sum up some time, Jesus is talking to the Pharisees. Pharisees were the church people, some of us. They were the best of the best at worshiping and following God. And so Jesus tells three stories. I'll sum up the first two. The first one is that a shepherd has 100 sheep and he loses one. And he has 99 left and he leaves the 99 and he goes to search for the one. And when he finds the one, he celebrates. He throws a big party. The second story is about a woman who has 10 coins. She loses one coin. She tears apart her house. She sweeps up the place to find the one coin. And when she finds the one coin, she celebrates. And then Jesus begins this story in Luke 15, verse 11. It says, Jesus continued that there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had and he set off for a distant country. And there he squandered his wealth with wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that country and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to the fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I'll set out and I'll go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your servants. So he got up, he went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son and threw his arms around him, and he kissed him. The son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against you and heaven. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So they began to celebrate. So let's stop there for a moment. If you've been around Christianity for a while, you've probably heard this story or this parable. It's often called the prodigal son. On the surface, what the younger son did was pretty bad. But if we dig a little deeper and we think about the context in which this story was told, we would see that this is probably the most despicable story these people could have heard. The son goes up to the father and he demands his inheritance. That's not great, but it's not that bad, right? It's his. No, it's not. Inheritance is only yours once the person who owns it has died. So what the first century hearers would hear is, "Father, I don't care about your life. I wish you were dead. I want what's mine. Give it to me now. Your life has no value to me." That makes it a little worse, huh? That makes it feel like, man, this kid's not great. Well, then he, not only does he take take from his father, but then he goes away from his father, which is extremely countercultural. People would grow up and live and die in the same towns. So he leaves his family. He takes everything that his father has worked so hard for, and he squanders it on self-indulgence. To the younger son, the present was all that mattered. Happiness and pleasure were his ultimate motivators. But soon he realized that he screwed up. When he's sitting there in a pig pen, looking at the pig slop, thinking, "Oh man, I wish I could eat that." He realized, okay, I've messed up, but I can fix this. I can get my way out of this. If I just go home, pull myself up by my sandal straps, and I serve my father, I can fix it. He assumed that if he got himself into it, he can get himself out of it. This is an apt description of people in the Pacific Northwest. Seattle has long been a microcosm of free thinking and cutting edge Western culture. It's a bastion of free thought where free living and happiness and pleasure and incredible self-indulgence reign supreme. Our friends and family think that the present is the only thing that really matters. What we as Pacific Northwesterners want far outweighs what we may need in the future. Our area is full of younger sons, rejecting the heritage and legacy and traditions of their parents in order to find their own way, no matter the cost. Like the younger son, the pursuit of each individual's peace and truth and happiness and reality or whatever buzzword you want to attach to it is paramount, even if it costs someone else something. Now, Pacific Northwesterners wouldn't say that what they want costs somebody something, but everything costs somebody something. That's just the world we live in. Then there's the second piece of this younger son mentality. Once people in the Pacific Northwest realize that incredible self-indulgence is not very fulfilling, that hedonism doesn't bring them the happiness that they desired, we often turn to work. "Well, if I just work hard enough, I can earn my happiness, right? If I just find the right yoga class, I'll find my center. If I spend enough time in nature, I can reconnect with the universe. If I feed enough unhoused people, I will get the cosmic scales in balance and everything will just be okay." We attempt to work our way out to the things that we value so much. This is the nature of lostness in the Pacific Northwest where we planted a church. There are 250,000 people within 15 minutes of our church building. 15,000 of them claim to follow Jesus. If math isn't your friend, that means that 235,000 people within 15 minutes of our building don't know Jesus. 235,000 younger sons. 235,000 people lost in searching for worldly pleasure or lost in searching for the work that will get them in right standing with God. This is why I believe that God recklessly sent us to Washington and why we recklessly followed. Because you see, God is the father in this parable. When the father sees the younger son coming, he runs to him, he wraps his arms around him. In fact, for the father to have even seen him from a far way off means that the father was looking for him. The father was searching for him. And when the son comes back, the father gives him right standing immediately. He doesn't send the son away. He doesn't make the son work for it. He doesn't even ask to make sure that the son's repentance is real. He just throws his arms around them and he kisses him. He clothes him and he puts a ring on his finger. This ring is a signet ring, which shows that this son is in full right standing with the father, that he has authority, that he is a son again. And then he takes the fattened calf. And he says, let's eat it. Now, meat was a really expensive commodity in this society. The fattened calf is like the meat that they have been waiting for. They take one calf and they just continually feed it, and they wait until it's just choice and prime, and they use it. It's the most important meat that the people could think of. And the father says, you know what? That's the meat I want to use to celebrate my son. He rejoices that his son was, for all intents and purposes, dead. And now his son is alive. And he's going to hold nothing back in that celebration. You see, I left out an important piece of those first two stories. After Jesus said that the people who had found what they had lost through a party, Jesus ended by saying, so do the angels in heaven. Every time that a sinner repents, every time that one person steps over the line of faith, all of heaven celebrates. So that's why this father is celebrating. But the story doesn't end there. See, act one of the story is really incredible. It's breathtaking, and it really has me like ready to go, and I hope it has you ready to go, loving, hurting, and broken people. It's not a story about us. It was once our story. But Jesus doesn't end this story with the first son. There's an act two. The second act is directed towards his audience. His audience is church folk, like me. Let's look at verse 25. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. Your brother has come home, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. The older brother became very angry and he refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so that I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him? My son, the father said, you are always with me and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost, is found. Guys, the elder son had done everything right. He never left. He worked hard. He obeyed. He was in right standing with the father. But when his younger brother comes home, somehow the younger brother is celebrated and not the older. I can understand this frustration. I would probably be just as angry. But it goes even deeper than that this brother just didn't get a celebration. You see, if the younger son is welcomed back into the family, where does that inheritance come from? It comes from his. When the younger brother took half of the estate, now there was only half there, but it was all the brother's. But if they welcome the younger son back in, now that older son is half as rich, or if you grew up like me, twice as poor. So I get it. I empathize with the older brother. It would cost him something to forgive the younger brother. It would cost him a lot. Now, I know that none of you look at your lost friends and don't want them to know Jesus. I know that none of you would cease celebration if a dead person came back to life. So, knowing that, how does this older brother relate to us? Well, what's the older brother's justification for his anger? His words are that I have been slaving for you many years and I've never disobeyed your orders. Essentially, the older brother says, look how good I've been. Look how well I have obeyed. Look at all the work that I've done. Don't I deserve more? Friends, I'm some tattooed, long-haired, denim, sleeveless coat, hooded coat wearing guy from the Pacific Northwest. So I'm not going to talk about you for the next couple minutes. I'm just going to talk about me, okay? If you feel like I'm talking about you, maybe that means there's something about you that you and God got to deal with. But I'm just talking about me from now for the next couple minutes, okay? Friends, I am like the older brother. I may not outwardly refuse to celebrate the lost coming home, and I probably wouldn't even do that inwardly. But I find myself going to God when people are getting the things that I want, getting the things that I prayed for, and saying something like this. God, I moved across the country for you. I gave up my life for you. I know your word. I obey your rules. I love people. I love my wife. I'm leading this church that you told me to plant. I did all of this for you. And even with that, even with all of those things I did for you, I still had to watch my brother die. I still had to watch my baby die. I still have to check my bank account to make sure that my bills are paid. God, I still have sleepless nights asking all the time, did I make a mistake moving here? God, why do other churches grow but mine doesn't? Why do people get to have kids, more kids, than we don't? Why do people get to live in their dream home while I can barely afford to pay the rent on someone's investment property? God, I did everything for you. Don't I deserve more than this? I can't believe that you would bless someone who's done less for you or done nothing for you. Guys, this isn't hyperbole. This isn't exaggeration. This is real. This is the reality for me. I am the older brother. While I believe that grace is free, and while I believe that I have been granted salvation through grace, by faith, so that I can't boast about it, somehow something inside me still thinks that I have to work to earn things. And when my standing with God depends on my ability to obey him and do the right things, I will fail to love and celebrate what God is doing in others. I'll fail to see what he's doing in other people's lives because my insecurity in knowing that I can't uphold God's law causes me to lash out. In my mind, there are people who are worse than me that have it better than me. In my heart, I then begin to think, well, maybe I'm not as good as I think I am. And so I try harder. And this constant weight of work and worry, it's just exhausting. And because my soul is tired, I lash out like anyone does when they're tired. When I'm running on the energy that grace affords me, all is well. Love abounds. The fruit of the Spirit is evident in my life. But when I start to put on a works-based righteousness, I begin to carry the burden of my standing with God on my back. I begin to believe that that how well and how moral I am, how well I obey God, how much I love and how much I do depends on how right I am with God. And then my soul gets tired because it was never made to carry that burden. In the Pacific Northwest, just like here, older sons like me create younger sons. So many people that we have met in the Pacific Northwest don't want anything to do with Jesus, don't want anything to do with church, because all they know about church and Jesus is that there are a bunch of tired and angry people there. There are a bunch of Christians who are bitter and resentful. There are a bunch of Christians like me struggling to remember that the grace that saves us also sustains us. And that it's always been that way, and it always will be that way, and it will always be free. Friends, this story isn't really about the first son, where it often gets its name, the prodigal son. Do you know what prodigal means? It means reckless. The story isn't even about the second son. The story is about the father. In both acts, the father is the one leaving everything behind to go seek and save that which was lost. Both the younger son and the older son. He was the one who welcomed in the wantonly sinful younger son with open arms. He was the one who left the party to go save the wantonly elder brother and invite him in. The story is about a prodigal God. It's about reckless love. This story is why Jess and I went to Washington to watch God make dead people alive. This wantonly prodigal God. The last thing I want to pull from this story is, who was the one that really should have been looking for the younger brother? Who was the one who should have been waiting with open arms to celebrate? Should have been the older brother. The older brother was there working for his father, thinking that's what his father wanted, when all his father wanted was his son to come home. But it was more comfortable. It was less reckless for the older brother to stay and to work. He could control things that way. He didn't risk anything that way. Friends, now I'm talking to you. Where in your life is God asking you to be a little more reckless or to take a risk? You see, one of the reasons that we like to be like the older brother is because the idea of free grace actually terrifies us. If grace is earned through works, then there's a limit to what can be asked of us. If we earn something, we have the right to it. And there's an agreement that we will be paid for the work that we do, and we can refuse the work we're not willing to do. But if grace is free, like the Bible teaches, then there's no limit to what God can ask of us, because there is no limit to what God gives to us. We don't have a leg to stand on when we refuse to do what he asks if grace is free, and that is scary. I believe that much of what he will ask us to do is reckless to us. I believe much of what he may be asking you to leave behind will seem reckless to us. Much of what he asks us to do will not be what we have earned or what we think we deserve. Maybe he's asking you to recklessly leave your home that you have paid off, your family that you love here, a job that you've worked for so long, and come with us on mission. It doesn't make sense for you to leave that job. It doesn't make sense for you to leave that family. You will lose money. You will lose a quality of life that you have been accustomed to. You will be surrounded by people who don't want you there. But friends, let's not be the elder brother of this story, but let's be this elder brother that Jesus wants us to be. He was the elder brother for us. He took on cosmic homelessness to help us find our home. He knows that forgiveness wasn't free, and he welcomed us home anyway after giving up everything he had. He welcomed us into his rightly earned inheritance. He left all that he knew. He was surrounded by people who hated him. He suffered, and he was humiliated all so we could be invited in. God is a prodigal father, prodigal son. He's a prodigal God.